Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra brings this season to a close with an opera that was shocking then, but's beloved now, Carmen by Bizet. Here to chat about it, our music director, RPO music director Ward Stair, Sandra Peaks-Eddy, and Dinyar Vanya. Welcome all to discuss the play. So,
Thank you, Julia.
This is sort of your thing now. Closing with an opera.
Sort of my thing. Oh.
why Carmen?
Well, first of all, I love it. It's one of those pieces that you hear excerpts from all the time. I mean, it's ubiquitous. I mean, it's everywhere, you know, from TV commercials to other pop culture, you know, applications. But aside from the big numbers that we all know and love, which are great, there's just so much wonderful music in there. The whole opera is a masterpiece. I mean, it's beautiful, the way the textures are written in the orchestra, the way the voice, the vocal lines, the coloring, the character of it, the drama is all there in the music. I mean, I just think it's one of the great masterpieces in the repertoire. I mean, it's not just about the Toreador song or the Habanera, or it's so much more than that. And so it's a piece that I've always loved, and I thought that in our progression of operas we've done here, since I've been here, Traviata, Bohème, I thought, let's do Carmen.
It's time. You know, this is often the first opera that people see.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's accessible. It's a story that you know, has a lot of different angles to it, so I think
they know the tunes.
Yeah, and people.
That's what you said. Every song
exactly,
is pretty recognizable
exactly.
All the way through, and they enjoy it from.
And the story is so riveting as well. Yeah. So like everybody is falling for the wrong person in their lives, right? So this is like two people that fall for each other that really shouldn't be together. Yeah. So
actually, you commenting on this is often the first opera. This is actually the second opera that I ever saw, and. Growing up in Syracuse, New York, that was where I was exposed to opera for the first time because I had a company. And first opera I ever saw was Rigoletto. This was the second opera because they did it one year after the next. And I remember almost everything about that performance, and particularly the tenor. And thinking about it now, I pretty much remember the biggest impression I had was, wow, that was pretty good. I think to myself, why wasn't it a little bit better? And that's the one memory I have of the whole thing. But every other aspect of it, I remember that I loved.
So and you made this your life's career. You were going to do better.
No, I mean, I like to think that. But, you know, that was the very naive impression of a 17-year-old kid who thought, like, he was going to conquer the world one day. You know, so, but that was, you know, kind of where it all began. And it's still, you know, now, after all this time, after so many performances of this opera and spending, you know, 20 years almost studying it from time to time and covering it so many times and then finally getting to sing it and singing it over and over again, then I think it's when you learn the most about it and how you feel comfortable with it and, you know, get the most experience going.
A lot of people didn't feel comfortable with this when it was first performed, which we will
absolutely
get to. But we were talking about voices. One of the things that strikes me about this is the lead is a mezzo. You know,
thank goodness. There's not enough mezzo leads out there.
What is with all these soprano
I know,
parts?
Either sopranos or countertenors. I'm like, oh, come on, give me some more leads out there. So but no, I really enjoy this part so much because the music and the drama are so equally matched. I feel that with this opera, the tunes are beautiful, but also I know this sounds like such a cliche, but I feel like I really can lose myself in it because the character is such a complex, interesting character.
So a very brief, because it's actually not that complex a plot, but a very brief plot line for Carmen.
Well, I mean, it's simple, but there's also a lot of layers, which we can sort of get into. But
no, let's
okay,
not.
basically, you know, we're talking about a town in Seville that, in like the early part of the 19th century, I think, is where it's supposed to be set. And we have Carmen, who's kind of I guess she's a gypsy, but she's, you know, in with the cigarette girls in the factory too in the beginning, so she's a little bit of a mystery in the beginning. But it opens, there are a bunch of soldiers on stage just sort of guarding at their post, and they're watching the crowd go by and sort of trying to pass the time. Then the bell rings, the factory lets out on a cigarette break for there's the cigarette girls, you know, and they're all sitting there smoking, talking about how wonderful it is to take their break. And it's just, you know, really simple things that happen.
Step outside to smoke for the yin and the yang of it.
Exactly. Yeah, kind of thing. And then we meet Carmen, who comes out, and it's clear right away that she's, you know, a real character, and she commands the attention of the men and the women, and she's just like this. She's a force of nature, really. Mm-hmm. She comes out. So we meet her. She tries to seduce this really pure, innocent, wonderful, lovely young soldier named Don Jose, who starts out, you know, he's the one who has the most interesting journey, I think, throughout the entire opera.
We'll get to that.
But we'll get to that. I know.
We're going to be talking to Tina.
Right. So, okay. Right.
Get ready.
So anyway, she begins the process of seduction, and it's sort of the seed is planted, but then I almost said Dinyar. Don Jose's girlfriend, sweetheart from his hometown, comes with a letter from his mother, and they have a really sweet moment, and that's Micaela. And you get the and her music is so pure and so beautiful throughout her theme. It's just it really encapsulates everything she's about. So they have this nice little exchange. She leaves this letter for him, and from his mother, and he reads it and says, "Yes, I'll make her my wife." And so it's all pretty and nice, great. Then, you know, stuff starts to happen, and you know, there's a big fight between the girls and the factory. Carmen comes out, she gets arrested, and Don Jose is the one who has to arrest her. She seduces him, cons him into letting her escape. Then he gets in trouble. Then they all have to run away with these. Well, they go first to this little sort of bar. Lula's Pastia, where Carmen has her friends, and they hang out, and they hook up with these smugglers, and it all gets like progressively darker. And along the way, we meet Escamillo, who's like the male version of Carmen, because he's like oozing sex appeal, right? Everybody, men want to be him, women want to be with him, that kind of thing, you know.
And sort of the George Clooney of his
right,
day.
Right.
It's and funny we always say George Clooney.
Yeah.
Every time.
He should be in a production of Carmen.
Yes, that sounds great.
So while Carmen has seduced Don Jose, Escamillo seduces Carmen, and so you get this really interesting dynamic because Jose has sort of rejected Micaela, and he's sort of going in this downward spiral. Then Carmen abandons him on his way down and tries to go off with Escamillo, who doesn't really care that much about her, even though he says, I mean, you get the sense that he's kind
it's
of
like
a player.
A trophy,
you
like
know,
a trophy.
Yeah.
He's kind a of cad. A,
exactly, yeah. Exactly. And then the whole thing sort of, you know, you really don't know what's going to happen. And at the very end, you know, the famous scene where the bullfight's going on, and he's...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Escamillo is in there about to do his thing, you know, being celebrated on his way into the arena. Carmen's there on his arm, and then the word is out that Jose's on his way, too, and then they have one last confrontation where he's desperately pleading with her to sort of come away with him. She rejects him, and his heart is broken, and his life is shattered, and his reaction is to kill her. And then so she dies, and then we were talking before we came into the studio about the different endings, because there are different ways to end the opera, whether they both die, whether just she dies. There's even now only Jose dying, I guess, apparently.
No, both of us.
Oh, both. Oh, yeah. I thought you said there was one where Carmen kills him. And then,
oh, that yeah. was yeah. one that was just recently done.
Someone yeah. did that interpretation. So there are a bunch of different ways to do it, but that's Carmen in a nutshell. Yeah.
That's a good nutshell, but one of the things that's difficult about this is there is no... And actually, this has got alluded to. Carmen got messed around with a lot after it opened, and there's no real definitive version of this.
No, there's so many different ways to do it. Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah, with a dialogue or with the recitative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. There's a lot of complications when it comes to finding what people would consider the true
definitive,
version. Yeah, definitive version of Carmen. And we've had a lot of experience, people having their different ideas about what happen, you know, how it should go, and whether there should be dialogue or sung recitative, or you know, just mildly spoken dialogue and things like that,
or but a little of both.
A little of both. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
Now there is one musicologist critic who feels that the lead in Carmen is not Carmen at all, but it's Don Jose, because your character takes.
I would agree with that statement 100%.
Yeah. I mean, just
says the
tenor.
Says the tenor.
Every time I do this,
I've been waiting my whole life for someone to make that statement. No, I'm kidding. No,
it's
Well, I mean, there obviously the story. I mean, she's the title character, and the story functions around her actions mainly, I think. Mm-hmm. But it is his journey in a sense. It's what the story of what Don José goes through from beginning to end, and that kind of makes everything happen. And it's his, in my opinion, it's his poor judgment and poor reactions, bad decisions, just a long list of mm-hmm. bad decisions that lead to where the story ends. You know? I think he's a, I don't think he's totally like a innocent kind of character that is victimized by her necessarily. I think he's a kind of guy who doesn't fit in anywhere in his life for some reason, and he, whether he has mental disorders or, you know, something along those lines, I personally, having gone through all the experience I have with it, I've come to the conclusion that Don José has syphilis. And I think that from the beginning of the story to the end, that's the journey that drives him into delusion and madness and utter chaos. And that's why he can't distinguish from reality, and his own delusions are the only things that make sense to him. So, and which is why it leads to her death.
How many times have you played Don José?
This is our fifth outing together.
Together. We did our first ones together yeah. in Kansas City in 2010.
I've done four without you, so.
Okay, so.
What, four plus five would be five, six.
It
would
be,
Ward is absolutely correct. It would be nine. Nine productions of this, yeah.
Wow. So, well, you know,
Sandy's done much more, I think.
I don't think it was much more. I think maybe 12.
So yeah. this is great for you, Sandy, because when you work with another actor as often as you do, you can really start burrowing down mm-hmm. and throwing in layers very easily
absolutely.
Into it.
Absolutely. It makes such a difference. When I found out we were doing this together, just automatically, I'm like, oh, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
So, and I'm so excited to make my debut here doing this role with a friend. So it's fantastic. Yeah.
Does the lack of staging have much of an impact at all in your performance?
Luckily, we do have the history together.
Yeah.
So we were able to kind of call upon previous ideas that we've had, and we just kind of know each other and know like, okay, this is the phrase where I need to stand still, or this is what I need here.
And there's a lot of those moments, you're right, that sort of just fix themselves, and we kind of don't really know how they get fixed, but we know that this is what's going to happen. Yeah, it's an instinctual thing.
Yeah.
That this is what is supposed to happen for whatever reason, that usually does. So,
this was a piece that is notoriously famous for the fact that it essentially killed Bizet. It opened and it failed.
Mm-hmm.
And little did he know that the next time it would be performed, which was in Vienna, it would be a huge hit and take off from there. So this poor man has
died. And he died really young, didn't he? Died in his 30s.
Yeah, about 33 years old. And it was immediately after this play, after this opera opened. When we look at this with 2018 eyes, Ward, we don't get it.
Yeah, how could it? Yeah.
Why did people react the way they did the first time they saw Carmen?
Well, there are a lot. I mean, it was kind of a departure from, in the sense of the form. I mean, I think when it originally opened, it was dialogue, right?
Mm.
So there was no recit in there. And of course, you know, the whole opera comique singspiel thing was not really established yet at that point. And then the drama, the subject matter was much more, I think, real. It was kind of like, you know, Verismo, you know, hitting. I mean, talking about people, cigarette girls taking breaks and, you know, people with syphilis who go crazy and stab their lover and stuff like that. I mean, opera has always been dramatic, but, you know, in this case, I think the death of Carmen was, I remember reading somewhere that was one of the most shocking things, because it wasn't, you know, the heroine dying on stage of, consumption or something, a little less violent. I mean, it's still sad and tragic, but it's got a lot of violence. It's got a lot of humanity that's like more raw, I think.
Yeah,
and people weren't really ready for that back then.
It was also premiered at the Opera Comique, all places.
Which is,
you know,
supposed to be family fair.
Exactly.
Yeah. Guess what, kids?
Let's
try that again. I also wonder if perhaps the fact that this is a role, Sandy, that was and is a mezzo-soprano, not a mm-hmm. soprano. So this is a role that was, for a lead role, wouldn't that have been a little shocking to have this mezzo-soprano who's of loose character, shall we say, as opposed to many of the lead roles in opera, which were these pretty young things that were sopranos?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think that's all part of it. Yeah, it broke a lot of barriers and, you know, just it went there, you yeah. know, before a lot of other operas had, so.
Mm-hmm. Having the tenor that kills someone at the end.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, I mean, too.
Having, you know, your leading male character in the show murder the title character.
Yeah.
Are there any redeeming people? I mean, outside of Michaela, are there any people in this main characters that you would want living next door to you?
Well, maybe the smugglers, if they could
get some good contraband out of that.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Morales is pretty harmless, I guess,
right? Overall. In the beginning. There'd be some wild parties at his house.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know. But yeah, you wouldn't want Don Jose living next door. Yeah.
No.
And you know, Escamillo probably wouldn't live next door. So yeah. I don't think.
Well, he might if it was rent-free.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's an interesting concept to have an opera. I think repellent is too big a word. But to have an opera that is essentially populated only by repellent people, by people who are deeply flawed and maybe not very nice. That must have been quite a shock. I mean, but to us, to our modern ears and our modern eyes, that's nothing, but it's hard to tell. So how do you make somebody that is maybe a little very flawed attractive to the audience, Sandy? Yeah.
I feel whenever I'm playing this character, I feel like I try to search for her vulnerability. And I consider that her life must have been really very hard. She must have had a really hard life growing up and maybe going from town to town. I try to play her as a survivor, and that's why she cuts people, and that's why she sleeps with people, that's why she steals, she does what she needs to do. So I feel like to get to that point, I'm not trying to say, make her a victim, but I don't necessarily think of her as a villain, per se. I find that she's very strong character, and in some ways admirable because she sticks with her convictions. And at the very end, when Jose says, you know, I can change, I could do this, let me save you. When she hears him say, let me save you, she's like, no, I don't need anybody to save me. I'm fine. I'll live free and I'll die free. So maybe it's because I've played her many times, but I find her to be a very strong character. I find her to be, again, admirable because she is very set in her conviction. I mean, set in her ways could be a good thing or a bad thing because she does eventually die because of it. But I don't know. I think there is a lot of qualities in Carmen that are admirable, likable. And I don't think she's all evil completely.
And it's interesting because she does not change.
No.
She's the catalyst.
She's constant, yeah. And where Don Jose has a complete change.
And I think that goes to the root of the whole transition of opera as opposed to, because title character stands for more than being just averagely human. A title character is supposed to be someone who is constant, doesn't change, like the stars, like heaven, something like that. I think that's loosely, not heaven, but I think something that is constant and never wavering is something that she represents. And I think the human side of the story is what happens to Don Jose. He's flawed. He fails. He falls. He stumbles. Does horrible things. But he lives at the end. And I think that is a human existence. That's something that humanity goes through together. And I think that's something that is loosely represented in this in this piece, which is probably what I love about it the most. I love Don José for that fact, that he's horribly flawed, but he survives too. He lives. It's his flaws that allow him to still continue to move forward, even though it's in misery, even though he's just in awful muck of his mind, his heart, soul, body, the whole time. He still moves forward. And I think that's a struggle that very much so at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century, that was a Verismo opera was a lot like that, that there was a big idea of this human condition and how do we write about it and make it convincing.
Have you ever thought about what might be Don José's fifth act?
I have. I've often thought about like what happens to him after the bullfight's over.
Sure.
And he's found. I don't think he would leave her body. This is who he is now. Her death defines who he is forever. And whatever life he has after that, whether Escamillo finds him with her and just pummels him to death or stabs him with his matador's sword, that could be the case. Whether Zuniga comes back and finds him and either decides to kill him or arrest him, and he goes to jail, either goes to a prison or a work camp, gets, you know, demoted. He's still a nobleman, so he might get some kind of favor because his family may have land or something like that that he can exchange. But I think in the end, I think his best result is that he would not live much longer, and that little bit of life he has left will be spent in what anyone else would consider a personal anguish, but is just regular existence to him. Hmm. So I think that's how his mind works.
Ward, do you remember the first time you saw Carmen performed?
I don't remember the first time I saw it as well as I remember the first time I played it in the orchestra when I was in Chicago. And it was just, you know, everything I said before about it just being exquisite from beginning to end really struck me. And, you know, it was a long run, if I remember correctly, because Carmen sells well, so you do a lot of them. And every night, you know, I heard something different. Every night I had a different reaction or a more, you know, more layered reaction to each scene. And I just thought, wow, this is just a gift that keeps on giving. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an amazing,
it really is.
Amazing work.
As a music director, you don't determine the dramatic interpretation. You just put it out there and everybody starts singing. Or am I wrong?
Well, I mean, I'm not the director, and I'm sorry that our director this week couldn't be with us, Sarah Witzer. She's been doing a great job in very little time, I have to say. But, I mean, the conductor is not the director, but the music is, especially in a piece like this, it's very much a part of the drama. Yeah. So, I mean, there were times in the last couple of days during our process where I would just turn around and say, okay, what are you doing there? Because they're behind me, which is really abnormal. Normally, I can see everything when I'm in the opera pit, which is great because you can tell, like, oh, okay, if a singer has to do something that's particularly awkward physically, sometimes you have to change the phrase a little bit to accommodate that, and you have to know, you know, what the physical action is and how it will affect the musical phrases. And sometimes, you know, that's when the conductor has to stand up to the director on behalf of the singers if there's something that's just not working. But we didn't have a long process like this and like that this week, and it's actually been a lot of fun because you know, having artists, you know, of this caliber with Sandy and Dinyar, and also the fact that you have a history together, you brought a lot to the table right away, which is, that's the only way we could have done that, actually. So that was partly by design. And so, you know, having it all come together so quickly, we really just have to use our instincts. But we all have good ones, thankfully. So it's gone well.
And I would second that. I think the music director or the conductor of especially a piece like this, has a lot to do with what happens to us, especially, I think. So, and I, you know, Ward's been awesome through this whole process, and like the whole process feels like we've done 2 weeks worth of work in 48 hours.
Yeah, so it's amazing.
It was really intense. It was unbelievable.
And you have, we should mention that Madrigalia is playing the chorus and parts, and to there's that, because that all has to be blocked and brought in too.
Right.
It's a lot of work in a very short time.
It's a huge, I mean, we've just been escalating our opera offering every year. I mean, this was the most ambitious thing we've done yet, I think. And you know, it's going to be fantastic. I think the audiences are going to love it.
Yeah, the day that you do Dr. Atomic, everybody's just going to be amazed.
I was going to say, next year, Ring Cycle.
That's right.
Yeah. They had there the plane go. Land from Nixon in China. Yeah.
Nixon in China. I love Nixon.
Looking forward to that. Do you take this into account when you put together your big last finale, your opera? Do you think about length or production or difficulty or the fact that it has to be brought together so quickly?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, this was, and I knew this would be pushing the limits of what we could do within the boundaries of our normal rehearsal week. So I don't think we could go any bigger than Carmen without adding time to the prep process, because this was pretty much at the limit. But I have to say, I was really proud of the orchestra, because, you know, they're a great orchestra, but they're not an opera orchestra. So most orchestras perform, you know, the suites from Carmen, but they don't know all the little, and there's some tricky music in those passages that you don't play unless you play the full opera. And I have to say, the orchestra has done a marvelous job. They listen so well. They've just been on it. So
they sound fantastic.
Yeah, it's been great.
Beautiful.
And you know, we all know the suites very, very well. Mm-hmm. And if you're musicians, like instrumental musicians like Ward, you started playing that in sometimes junior high school.
Mm-hmm.
You've been playing the Toreador song forever.
Right.
So how significantly different are the suites from how those exact same pieces of music sound set inside of the opera?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, it's the short answer is it all comes down to context. And I'm a fan of suites because, you know, they get this great music out there, and they're easy to plug into a lot of different contexts on a concert program. I'm not just talking about the Carmen suite. No, I'm talking about any suite that you can think of. I mean, it's nice. But hearing, like, the Toreador song, for example, in the dramatic arc, as it was meant, of the opera is just so much more thrilling. I mean, the first time that we went through the whole thing in order, like, I started to get goosebumps a little bit when it happens, because just the way that you build to that moment, and it's not even the climax, but it's definitely a highlight. It's awesome, and it reminds me, I'll never forget the first time I played the Ride of the Valkyries in the Ring Cycle. And when the Ride of the Valkyries comes, the opening of Act 3 in Die Walküre, it's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that piece is great, and it stands alone in a concert, but when you hear it after the end of Act 2, it's like, holy blankety blank blank.
Yeah.
That is powerful. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm just getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
Yeah.
It's so when you hear these awesome tunes that you know and love in context, it's a really powerful experience.
Yeah.
Mm. We look forward to being able to hear everything in context this weekend with your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Julia Figueres, and many thanks to you, Ward, and congratulations, by the way, on a good, solid, and successful season. Because this is your season closer.
It is. Thank you very much. It's been great.
It really has been. So congratulations to Ward Steer, our Carmen Sandra Peaks Eddie. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And our Don Jose Di Nirvana, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. If you would like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.